Shirley. So that's why we got this name. I'm Avery Fox. I'm a doctoral student here in the Department of Art History, and that's why I'm up here talking with you, and that's why we're in this space in the Department of Art History. Before we get started, I want to really quickly thank a few people for helping this put together. First, I need to thank the Department of Art History in general. My field of study is 18th century British art, which is very specific, but they still let me teach a course on comics over the summer, and they encourage all of our students to kind of explore their own interests. So that was one of the germs, the genesis of this event. I need to thank a couple people in the department, Quint, who's in the back corner taking pictures, and Lori, who run this space, the Michelle Smith Collaboratory for Visual Culture, and really have helped put this on. I want to thank all the artists who I'll introduce in a moment for generously donating their time, especially with the Small Press Expo less than 24 hours away, and they're here. And in particular, I want to thank Lex Fajardo, who's kind of, he was the one who first got in contact with me and sort of started this idea, and Rob Ullman, who found a bunch of the artists on the panel, so those guys in particular helped this happen. And finally, I want to thank the Small Press Expo, which is tomorrow and Sunday in Bethesda. I got in touch with them. They were very enthused about this event, helped me put together some of the stuff, and they gave these flyers that are good for a free admission to the convention. So they donated those. When I told Warren, the director, about it, he said, sure, I'd love to have students. His language was a lot more colorful. But that was the gist. So without further ado, I want to introduce really briefly our five panelists. They're going to talk about themselves. I'm just going to give you a little bit of background information. In alphabetical order, first we have Carolyn Rafalski, who is a DC area artist, who was nominated for the 2010 Friends of Lulu's Most Talented Newcomer. She creates the comic strip Curls and collaborates with writer Joe Carabillo on the comic books Kid Roxy, Black Magic Tales, and The Leggettes. Her latest work was featured in Indie Comics Magazine and Magic Bullet. And she's also a designer at Marcom Group Incorporated, which is a full-service advertising agency based out of Fairfax. Alexis Fiardo is a student of the classics, whether Daffy Duck or Damocles, and has created a unique blend of the two in Kid Beowulf, which is a series inspired by the epic Old English poem Beowulf, and traces the journey of twin brothers Beowulf and Grendel and their adventures. So far, Lex has published two books in the Kid Beowulf series, and the third, Kid Beowulf vs. El Cid, will be released next year. Lex is based in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he's taught cartooning. He currently lives in Santa Rosa, where when he's not penning Kid Beowulf, he works at the Charles M. Schultz Studio, overseeing the various publishing projects for Peanuts. On the far end, Monica Gallagher is a graphic designer, illustrator, and comicer from Baltimore, where she lives with her boyfriend and two dueling cats. She's written and illustrated both awkward autobio and fiction stories, including Gods and Undergrads, Boobage, Lipstick and Malice, and Bonnie and Clyde. She currently finished illustrating a full-length graphic novel for Oni Press. Her books tend to focus on women with choices to make, self-esteem and self-empowerment. All of that and the boobs and violence, too, can be enjoyed by any audience. Jim Rugg hails from Pittsburgh, where he works full-time as a freelance illustrator and graphic designer. Jim is actually a featured guest at this year's Small Press Expo and designed the program cover. His personal work uses the style and vocabulary of comics to question and lampoon consumer culture and address the challenges and realities of a complex world of race, gender, politics, religion, and society. Along with co-writer Brian Maruca, Jim created Aphrodisiac, a blaxploitation superhero comic which was nominated this year for 5 Glyph Comics Awards, which are given to works by, for, and about people of color. And also for the Eisner, was also nominated for the Eisner Award for Best Human Publication. In 2010, his mini-comic Rambo 3.5 won the Ignatz Award for Most Outstanding Mini-Comic at the Small Press Expo, which means that it will be archived at the Library of Congress as part of the Small Press Expo collection venture that was just announced at the beginning of last week. And last but not least, Rob Ullman is also a freelance illustrator and graphic designer who proudly represents Pittsburgh, even though he now lives in Richmond. His work has appeared in Virginia Living, The Stranger, and the Washington City Paper. Rob's comics include Atom Bomb Bikini, Grand Gestures, and my personal favorite, Old Time Hockey Tales. Tomorrow at SPX, and this is still true, he's debuting his latest book, Animal Alphabet.
Animal Alphabet, no, unfortunately.
Okay.
But Hockey Tales.
All right.
Animal Alphabet did not quite make it off the presses. Right.
Still working on Animal Alphabet. Yeah. He's at Small Press debuting the latest issue of Old Time Hockey Tales then. So with all the panelists introduced, I'm going to turn the floor over to them. They're just going to talk a little bit about their own work. And then once we get through that, once each artist has the opportunity, we will turn the floor over to you. Ask questions, I'll moderate a discussion. So first is Carolyn Gillespie. Thank you.
So this is my info, and I'll share it with you guys again at the end of the conversation if you want to ever check me out online, go to the website, and get in contact with me. My website is curls-studio.com, and you can get all the links from there. So I'm an art director, an illustrator, a cartoonist, a designer, anything art-based, pretty much I have knowledge about. Some of my influences, I think a lot of things start with stuff that you are embraced with early on, and for me it was Bugs Bunny and Chuck Jones. Like, ever since I can remember, ever since I was a little kid, even 1 or 2 years old, I just remember seeing a lot of Bugs Bunny cartoons, and that I think really influenced me my whole entire life. My Little Pony. You can't deny it. Something about it just really influenced me as well. And I continue to this day to do stuff that's influenced by My Little Pony. Also, when I was younger, I did enjoy Pee Wee Herman and Pee Wee Herman's Playhouse. You know, there's something about the characters that really told all the stories, the imaginative colors, and the storytelling behind this TV show really, like, awoke in me as a young child. So I still feel like I continue with this show to this day. And the movie A Christmas Story. Here we have pictured the leg lamp from The Christmas Story. And I really felt like that was my family. And I loved the humor in it. I loved Gene Shepard's writing from that. And for those of you that don't know, Gene Shepard is actually, he did old-timey radio shows. And he's like the greatest storyteller. It's amazing. And maybe it influenced the Leggetts. And Leggetts is my comic book with Joe Carveo. He's actually sitting in the front row, so if you want to talk to him later after the show, you can too. So he talked to him about writing and filmmaking. All right. So those are my influences. What about inspiration? Okay, I love turtles. And so, you know, we have to acknowledge the Terps. Congratulations on your new football outfits. I think that they're awesome. All right, I really like goats that climb trees. I don't know about, I don't know what it is, but they inspire me, and whenever I'm having a bad day, this goes good with the background, too. Whenever I'm having a bad day, I just Google goats climbing trees. It makes me feel a whole lot better. Try one. The Pontani sisters, I started getting into admiring burlesque dancers, and immediately the Pontanis influenced me. They're from New York and New Jersey. And they really have a great sense of style, great duo. They involve dance. They make all of their headpieces and their outfits, and they really embrace being creative to a whole nother level and performance art. And then my other influence is Jeff Smith, the creator of Bone. If you're just getting into graphic novels, or I'm sure if you already are reading comics, you're already familiar with Bone. This man, basically, him and his wife self-published the book. They own all the rights to it. It's amazing how far he's taking it, and this is the 20th year anniversary. So, just knowing that he built that up just by himself without, now he's being published by Scholastic, but, you know, he didn't have any major backing or anything. So just to know that he is successful and made it is a big inspiration to me. All right. This is my webcomic, Curls. Let's just dive right into it. Again, you can see it at curlsstudio.com/curls. All right. Now, these are some strips that might not seem great, but these are what I first submitted when I was going to the to VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, and basically they had an ad in the school paper that said, looking for a cartoonist, submit some art. So I was like, you know what, I need to do this, because I've always been drawing, and, you know, even in fourth grade I made my first characters. So, you know, at this time I'm like, I need to start actually doing something with it. So I submitted these strips. The editor liked the strips, and so I started getting published twice a week on Monday and Thursdays. Gradually, the art got a little bit better. So you can see some... I personally think it's a little bit better. So, you know, because I quickly, like, did the strips, you know, that day. I was like, well, they need a cartoonist. I can do this. And I rushed over to the editor's office. See some of the strips here, and like even with the Macy's parade, like that's my dream in life, is to actually have one of my characters be a balloon in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. Like, that's my ultimate life goal. And then, you know, I started adding some colors. I think that the art, like, progressively got better just by the more that I did, you know, doing two strips a week. And I really learned a lot about storytelling and developing the characters. I created Burton Eyes, a Photoshop filter, which basically makes everything you do turn into something Tim Burton would make. I let my imagination take over, and I enjoyed exploring the world that I created with these characters, and they really just like to have fun and explore life. And this one is from Cul-de-Sac. They're doing a, I guess a kind of like a tribute book or an admiration book of Richard Thompson's Cul-de-Sac, and he actually won the Reuben Award, which is a major award for being like the best cartoonist of the year. So this book will be coming out soon, and a lot of people contributed to that. And this is my stuffed toast. It takes about 6 hours to make by hand. So we have Toast of the Town. And here's, like, a color example of where the direction of Curls is headed now. Because in the school newspaper, it's printed in black and white. So we're merging onto color now, getting progressively better. All right. I also do design. I work at Marcom Group in Fairfax. And luckily today, they let me come here today and not work. So I really am thankful of that. So here's some of the design examples of stuff that I've done in the past year. NGA, we do a lot of stuff for government agencies. So if you have any graphic design questions, ask me. And also, you know, we work at a full service ad agency, and there's a lot that goes on with even like how you deal with clients. And it's more than just creating something. You have to get a lot of things approved. This is for Air Force Civil Service. We did a full interactive website with them. And the top of it starts with outer space, and then below, you can see these three panels, goes down to the underground. So we get to see a whole landscape of all the stratosphere, atmosphere. This is a mock-up for a jewelry store. Some concepts. Voce, we did logo design for them. I did their website and the logo design and color palette. This is their Shakespeare CD I designed. So I like to incorporate a lot of illustrative stuff in my design work whenever possible. And NRC. So as you can see, we have a lot of government contracts. All right, freelance. I do also freelance design on the side because, you know, you can never do enough art besides, like, working a full-time job and doing your comics. So this is some stuff. I worked with Fire Studio to create a silkscreen poster for Aardvark Art Bazaar. And here you can see some of how I work. I always carry a sketchbook with me. So if any of you are either writers, designers, or aspiring comic artists, always carry your sketchbook with you and doodle anything that comes out of your head. So we have a whole bunch of concepts about the aardvark, and they were talking about having it be, like, alphabetical with the A, and everything went on, so I was like, how about let's have him just surfing on an art palette? So I changed the concept a little bit, and that worked, and they approved it. And it's really cool to see a silk screen of your work. And this is for Delray Baby. Came up with the logo design concept and colors and how it would be implemented on a onesie. This is for a Christmas card. And you, here you can also see my sketch beforehand. This part right here, oh, I should take advantage of this laser. Okay. This part right here is like a really, really literal thumbnail. Like, it was literally the size of my thumb that I drew. So we have two cats and a dog sledding. And then here I worked on the illustration to make it more tight as a pencil stage. And then here we have the final color. And then I worked with National Geographic for their Great Migration series about maybe 6 months ago. So we did a whole bunch of bags and shirts and hats and caps and basically all the merchandise to go with that TV show. So that was really exciting to be able to say, hey, I work at National Geographic. Everyone's heard of them. All right, let's talk more about comics. That's what we're here for. All right, so Kid Roxy, this was my first comic book ever in 2006. And I worked with Joe Carbeo on this, and he's the writer. And Kid Roxy is about two girls. In this episode, they're in their first day of school in eighth grade. One of them dyes their hair over the summer, and things drastically change because they went from a, you know, sister friendship to now, you know, one of them is being drawn into the popular group. So we get to see what goes on there. Black Magic Tales, we take the same characters from Kid Roxy and basically intertwine them with their future life of becoming career criminals. So we get the innocence and now the crime. So here's Roxy and Dean. So we have Dean Casanova and Roxy Monroe, and then they have a cat named Black Magic, and he comes with them on all their crime sprees. And these are two pages from Magic Bullet, which is a comics newspaper put out by Washington, D.C. artists. I actually have a few copies with me, so if you want a free copy after the show, come up to me and ask for one. And more Legettes. Three women who are burlesque dancers, they are inspired to save the world in the future, where analog and digital are being in constant battle, and it gets to be the point where, like, major wars are being fought. This is dangerous stuff. So here's some examples of some Legettes pages from Legettes number one. And here we have a photo shoot with Dolly Holiday. She's a burlesque dancer from Richmond, an actual burlesque dancer, and we made her be Layla Legette, and she's holding up the silkscreen shirt that we have for the Legettes, and this just shows you how big of a world you can make your art, you know, like, she looks like she could be cast in a movie right now for the Legettes. She's glamorous, she's beautiful, and that's completely the character. And Joe shot these photos of her with Deco as well, and Deco is the evil corporation in the Legettes world. And we also did a comics anthology with a lot of really great illustrators and even storyboard artists that work for Disney and Warner Brothers, like Kenneth Rockeford now. He's with Superman, and Rafael Navarro, he'd worked on like Stripperella and a whole bunch of Batman stuff for Warner Brothers Animation. Elizabeth Wattison, she worked, she did the comic book Charm School in the 1990s, early 2000s. She works for Walt Disney, or she did work for Walt Disney at one point. So it was interesting, like, I branched out to all these artists and asked them to do a story about carnivals. So this is our work for Kid Roxy from that carnival anthology. And this is an illustration of Wonder Woman. We did this for Wonder Woman Day and ended up being on their shirts, which was really cool, at Comic Fusion in New Jersey, comic shop in New Jersey. And then the best part about really doing the comics is meeting people and going to the conventions. And this is a collage of some of the sketches I've done for people. I love doing commissions for people. And I really love getting out, because as an artist, you're sitting alone by yourself usually most of the day, and it's so nice to, like, be able to talk to people. So I recommend, like, honing your skills and then getting out there and showing people what you can do. Even, you know, even some of my early curl strips, you know, look at how much I think that they've progressed, you know, since the early days. So if you get out there and show people, you know, it'll motivate you to do more work. Whereas if you just stay stagnant, if I didn't do any of those old, you know, illustrations, like, I wouldn't be where I'm at right now. I kind of, like, had to get them out. It's like an athlete training. If you don't run, if you don't exercise, you're not gonna progress. So thank you very much for having me here. And here's my contact information if you want to write it down. And I can take questions, or we're going to do those later. Okay. If you have questions, we'll take it later. Write it down so you don't forget. Thank you.
So I think you're up next. Is this the laser?
Yeah.
The top one's the laser.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I've never seen my work so big. So my name is Alexis Fajardo. I also go by Lex. And I'm just going to walk you through the project that I do called Kid Beowulf. First, I'd just like to give a big shout out and hello to my parents and my sisters who braved floodwaters from Binghamton to New York to make it down here, and because they love comics so much. So I do a book called Kid Beowulf. Heard a little bit about it at the beginning. This is basically the pitch that I give. If you were to stop at my table tomorrow at SPX, you would hear the exact same pitch I'm about to give you, except this has exciting visuals. So, first off, anyone here familiar with Beowulf? Read it in school or skipped over it? Or yeah, okay. So it's a, for those of you who are not familiar, it's an old epic poem from Scandinavia, and it's about a big Viking named Beowulf who goes off and kills a monster named Grendel. He wins fame and fortune. He goes on to kill Grendel's mother, and fights battles against Danes and Geats, and ends his life battling a dragon. His name is thrust into song, and we read it 2,000 years later. So that was really the premise for the story that I'm doing. These are actually some images that come from the first book, where I retell the Beowulf story for those who never read it. So there's the confrontation with Grendel, sort of the famous arm ripping, and then later on we see Beowulf going into Grendel's lair where he confronts Grendel's mother, slays her. This is a story that I read in epic poetry form in, I think, AP English, and I'd grown up reading all kinds of classical stories and Norse mythology and Greek stuff, and just fell in love with it. But Beowulf was the first that I read in epic poetry form. So it wasn't a novelization. Someone actually translated the Old English, and something about the language just really lit my brain on fire. I loved the language of it, the action of it. It was very poetic, and you could sort of see exactly what the poet was telling you about, and so it sort of visually it translated the comics really well. To my 15-year-old brain, it was just a great story with arm ripping and wenches and lots of fighting, but it stuck with me, and in college I went on to study classics and read Homer and Virgil and all the other great epics, but I always seem to come back to Beowulf. In my version, I have taken Beowulf, who is the great Viking warrior, and Grendel, who is the monster he goes to kill, and made them 12-year-old twin brothers. So it was a bit of a twist on the original tale. Whenever I tell that to Beowulf scholars, they completely freak. And you know, as a traditionalist myself, I can totally understand that. This right here is their pet pig, Hama, who is not canon. The basic conceit is as Beowulf and Grendel as 12-year-old twin brothers, and the idea is that brothers will travel across Europe and Asia, visiting all these different countries, first starting up in Sweden. Back then it was called Jutland and Daneland, And then sort of moving through France and Spain, Italy, Greece, saw these great countries in Europe, off into Asia. And along the way, the brothers will meet other heroes from those epic poems and legends of those countries, and interact with those heroes. Along the way, they'll grow up, and they'll sort of discover that one day they will have to fight each other. So Kid Beowulf is essentially a prologue to the events of Beowulf. This is the part of the journey when they come through Mesopotamia into India, all the way out to Japan, and then they will make their way back to their homeland. So it's really a one long road trip through mythology and epics and legends. And the hope is to, first and foremost, tell a really good story, and B, get folks interested in these stories that they may have overlooked in the clamor of Batman and Superman and other heroes. The first book was called Kid Beowulf and Blood and Oath. This came out a couple years ago. This is basically the origin tale of Beowulf and Grendel, why they were twin brothers. It's goes back to their forefathers. This crusty fellow right here is their grandfather, Hrothgar. And the story begins when he's a young prince and all the mistakes he makes and how that translates through the generations. This right here is Beowulf and Grendel's mother. I named her Gertrude. She's not really named in the poem, but I felt the need to be alliterative and also referencing the other great queen of Denmark. This right here, this ghostly fellow, is Egtho, who is Beowulf and Grendel's father. He begins the story with legs, then something happens. And the dragon here, the one-eyed dragon, this is actually the dragon that Beowulf will one day slay in the original epic, and he is their grandfather. So the first story is really just one messed up family drama. And I think it's something we can all sort of relate to. And it sets the stage for all the adventures of the brothers across Europe. The first place that they go to is France. And the inspiration for that was the epic The Song of Roland. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's an epic that centers around Charlemagne, the king right here, and his Justice League of Knights, who are called the Twelve Peers. And there are a few of them scattered around this image. During this time, Charlemagne was expanding his lands, and at one point he was moving into Spain to try and conquer Spain, where he met up against some tough Saracens, also known as Moors, who they're fighting right here, and discovered he really couldn't beat them. So he headed back into France through the Pyrenees, which actually looked a lot like this background. The story goes that Charlemagne was at the front of his train of the army, and towards the back was the rear guard, headed up by Roland. Roland and his men were ambushed by these Basques and slaughtered to a man. All that Roland can do was to blow his famous horn called the Oliphant to warn Charlemagne of the treachery and of the fact that the rearguard was decimated. Charlemagne comes back, sees that Roland is dead, sees that many of his peers have died, and decides to go back into Spain and take revenge on the Basques and the Saracens. That, like Beowulf, was committed to song, and it was sung over and over. It became actually a propaganda piece for the Crusades, and the names of Charlemagne and Roland and the pagan Saracens were always invoked to fire up Christian raiders. Mine is decided a little more lighthearted. I have elephants and giants and roller coasters, and this one is really an all-out action adventure for Beowulf and Grendel. They just have a heck of a time meeting Roland and Charlemagne and just sort of getting thrown into this big epic adventure. This one came out last spring, and the book that I'm working on right now is Kid Beowulf versus El Cid. This is the third book in the series, and it basically follows Beowulf and Grendel from their time in France and how they get lost in the Pyrenees and then end up in Spain, where they come across this young knight named Rodrigo, who will one day become known as El Cid. I don't know if you guys are familiar with El Cid, but it's another epic poem similar to Roland, in that it's roughly the same time period when there's Christians and Moors fighting each other for dominance in Europe. The events of El Cid take place in about 1060, whereas Roland, I believe, was in the 700s. So there's 300 years or so between them. But the crisis is still there, the crisis between Christian and Muslim faith, and Beowulf and Grendel sort of find themselves wrapped up in this adventure as well. Whereas the polarities of good and evil are very distinct in the Song of Roland. If you read the epic, Charlemagne is sort of the Superman, and he's doing all these great things for God, and the pagans are evil. When you read El Cid, it's much murkier. Rodrigo, this fellow here who becomes El Cid, he is a mercenary, and he fights for Christians, he fights for Moors. It's very nebulous, who's good, who's evil. Towards the end, he becomes known as a Christian hero. But during this time period, it was much murkier. And that's actually kind of fun for me to play around with as I do this story. This is sort of the origin story of how he becomes El Cid, why he becomes a mercenary, and see how Beowulf and Grendel get thrown into the mix as well. I'm hoping to have this one out for 2012, if the world doesn't end. Some of the primary influences for my work would be, as Carolyn mentioned, Bone by Jeff Smith. I'm a huge fan of his work as well. He did a 1,300-page tome of a graphic novel that he has tricked me into buying like a dozen different times. He's a master storyteller and a master businessman, and I really admire both of those aspects. Asterix and Obelix, I don't know if you guys are familiar with these guys. It's an old French comic, and I grew up reading this, and just loved the vibrant line work and the story. It's basically Asterix and Obelix are these two Gauls who are fighting Romans in ancient Gaul, and this, they have a magic potion that gives them these special powers. And it's just a lot of fun, lots of horrible puns, but great artwork. And then finally, Avatar: The Last Airbender, which is a more recent animated program from Nickelodeon. But I really admire the storytelling in this. It's vast. It's epic. It's a story of this young boy, Aang, who has the sort of the martial arts capabilities of harnessing powers of wind and fire and earth, and he sort of has to use these elements to bring about peace in the world. It's a really fun series. So the next stage, I just wanted to walk you through a couple of some of the process that I go through in creating a page. This is a double-page spread that comes from the second book, Beowulf and the Song of Roland. After I write out the script, there's a whole sequence of reading the epics over and over and reading histories and trying to break the story. But once I've broken the story and I've written the script, I do thumbnails, and I take those thumbnails and I transfer them to Bristol board. So this is actually drawn on 11 by 14 Bristol board, and I rule out the pages in blue pencil, and I use blue for a number of reasons. It's a little cleaner, and when I get to the stage, when I scan in the computer, because half my work is digital and half the work is traditional, the blue pencil allows me to not have to erase. And you'll notice that I'm a process junkie, so I like to see the blue line underneath the inks. So this is just basically a rough pencil stage, which I then spend some time inking. This particular page took a couple hours. Normally my pages are not quite this expansive or intricate, but for this double page spread I really wanted to do something special. This is a chase scene, as you can see. These guys right here, Ymir and Ermloth, are two Heathobards, which is a rival tribe that is from Daneland that have sort of tracked Beowulf and Grendel through the books. So here they actually find them in a French city, and chase ensues. So I ink with a variety of pens, primarily these beautiful Japanese brush pens, which make my work look much better than it really is. And I've bought tons of them and hope that they never go out of business. Once I have the inks, I scan in the pages into Photoshop, and I do all the cleanup. I basically drop the blue line, try and fix whatever little glitches there are, and I lay in what are half tones. The book at this point is not color, so I do some gray tones just to help the work read a little better, and it just gives a little more dynamics to it. And then finally, the final stage is throwing in the word balloons and the sound effects. This is where it really starts to come alive, and it feels like a comic. And you come up with all sorts of fun sound effects. And I have a font that I made out of my handwriting, so it gives it a little more of a handmade feel. There are some artists, and there might be some here, who actually do the lettering right there on the page. I don't have that facility, so I really look to Photoshop and a great family of fonts and try and use those as best I can. But that is basically the three-stage process for my work. The book's right there. These two are available, and then this one will be out next year. You can find it online. I do a production blog. I try and update at least once a week with new material, process sketches, character designs, and you can become a fan on Facebook, too. So search for me there. And thanks.
I wasn't planning on standing.
Okay,
so I don't really have as much of an organized presentation as everybody else did, so I'm just going to put out my first work that I started with. So I've been interested in comics my whole life, and primarily I think it was to start with Calvin and Hobbes and Garfield, and then I became wildly obsessed with a comic called ElfQuest, which is by Wendy and Richard Pinney, which is amazing, and it's kind of this long epic tale. It was done in the 70s and 80s, and it was all self-published, and it really inspired me to start creating my own stuff. I kind of got sidetracked a little bit by anime and manga, and I got interested in really copying the styles that I saw in Ranma One Half. Was a book by Rumiko Takahashi. Was a manga that I used to particularly enjoy. But it definitely got me drawing, which is something that I really appreciated. But I copied the style a little too much, so I had to generally like evolve everything into other stuff that I read and other stuff that I started to pick up over the years. So this behind me is a comic that I started when I was at the end of high school, beginning of college. It's called Gods and Undergrads. Read it with me. It's a webcomic primarily, but I still put it out into books because I prefer reading stuff in books. And it's basically about a girl at college finding out that her relatives are Greek gods. And of course, they all have to fight and big deal. But I saw a lot of comparisons when I was at college about like all that like heightened emotions and irrational thought and like craziness that I learned about in Greek mythology. I felt like the two really blended well together, so I really wanted to do a story about that. These are just a few pages, I think, from the fourth chapter that I've... And this is still ongoing online on my website. It just gives you an idea of what it looks like. So while I've been doing Gods and Undergrads, because I've been doing it probably... I realized this morning that I graduated college 10 years ago. So... feel pretty old being back at college campus. I went to UMBC and I took animation. And while I was there, I took this great English class that exposed me to all the EC comics, all the Mad comics, all the basically like historical progression of comics through the years since the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. So then I tried to refine my style a little bit, and I would get sidetracked along the way while I worked on Gods and Undergrads, and I do short stories. And most of them, let's see which one. Most of them are autobiographical. Boobage was one I did a couple of years ago, basically all about like my obsession with breasts, because I don't have them. So... I didn't find it terribly intrusive or embarrassing to talk about my boobs, but a lot of people have come up to me and been like, you know, why would you ever do that? And I've gotten lots of wonderful remarks from guys. But but a lot of them also buy the book, which is kind of like a trick. Some of them realize what it is, and some of them don't before they buy it. But actually, I was at the Baltimore Comic Con just last month, and this guy, I guess he was, I don't even remember, I guess he was a big jerk about it, but he bought the book, and then he wrote me an email later apologizing and saying, like, oh, it's about self-esteem, sorry. But I thought that was so funny that he took the time to actually write that. So Boobage is one of my autobiographical stories. I also have one. I don't have any pictures of it up here, but I brought my books if you guys want to flip through stuff. This one is about when I was a mall model. When I was kind of end of high school, early college, I decided that I wanted to start modeling. And if you decide that you want to start modeling, there's a lot of really awkward places that you can model for a while. This book kind of details like when I was, you know, put in a lingerie and made to stand in a mall for 4 hours pretending to be a statue, or just like running on stage and whatever I could fit on before like my name was called. It's just, again, it's awkward and it's autobiographical. And that's most of my short stories, I suppose, deal with just personal anecdotes, and most people tend to relate more to that than the stories where I've made up. But another story I have that I kind of pulled from that same experience is a series I have called Lipstick and Malice. And it's about a full-time model who works evenings as an assassin. I saw the two professions as really similar because when I was a model, I was given a date, a time, a location, and you wear this. And that was it. That was all the instruction. And I felt it was so similar to La Femme Nikita. I just felt like, you know, models are chameleons. They can fit anywhere because they're so skinny. No one would suspect them. So I started a whole series about that. More recently, I've started another webcomic called Bonnie and Clyde 9 to 5. And I started this when I got into roller derby. Woo! It's about a woman who works a 9-to-5 job just like I do, just like many people do, but she's also a roller girl, so all of her roller derby tendencies come out in the workplace. This is actually the first strip, and I think every strip after this, she actually wears all of her gear to the office. Like, she skates around. And I was inspired because I started watching this TV show they had only for a season called Roller Girls. You can rent it. It's really great. It's about a roller derby team in Austin. And that inspired me to start drawing about it. And then I heard about, I'm from Baltimore, so I heard that there was a Baltimore league and made the mistake of deciding that, you know, oh, I can totally try out. I was 29. I never skated. I was like, well, I'll just learn. It'll be no problem. And it was great. I spent a year and a half training and then eventually making the league and playing. I just stopped this January because I'd seen a lot of broken collarbones and broken legs, and I was really worried I was going to break my arm, so I kind of had to put that on hold. But this comic still goes on, and it's basically about how we survive the daily doldrums that we have to go through and somehow stay motivated and stay enthusiastic and optimistic. I think that's all the pictures I have. But as far as my other work goes, I spent the last year and a half illustrating a full-length graphic novel for Oni Press, and hopefully it'll be out next year. And I'm about to start writing and illustrating a book for them that I can't really talk about, unfortunately. But in the meantime, I'm going to put this on the dark one since that's great. There we go. In the meantime, I do have a full-time job. And I juggle that and keeping up with webcomics. I do freelance work. I try to post often enough on my blog that people will stay interested, which is tough, it seems like, nowadays. I've been going to conventions since 2002. I used to just go and have a table and advertise Gods and Undergrads as a webcomic and just say, like, here's a postcard, check it out, you know, go look for it. And eventually I graduated into making books, and now I love going to conventions. and talking to people and doing sketches and hearing people's different experiences. So.
My name is Jim Rugg, and like everybody else up here, I divide my time between freelance illustration and design. These are some of the projects I've done in that capacity. I'm also starting to exhibit artwork. This is some of my work from that. And as a cartoonist. As a cartoonist, I've self-published my own comics. I've worked with independent and small press publishers like SLG, Madhouse Book, and Picture Box. I've produced work for Marvel, DC, Image, and Dark Horse Comics, as well as non-traditional comics publishers, like McSweeney's on the left, that's for an upcoming cookbook. VH1 in the middle, that was for a documentary where it was basically Talking Heads telling this story, so they hired me to make a comic about the events that were being described and cut between the Talking Head interview subjects, and they kind of animated some of the elements of the comic strip. And on the right, New York Magazine, that was for their fall fashion issue a couple of years ago. They gave me a bunch of the clothing they were going to be highlighting and told me I could do whatever kind of story I wanted just to showcase the clothes. And I've had this experience with multiple publishers where they tell you you can do whatever you want, and they never, ever mean that. So I began reading comics in the late 80s or 90s. I was about 12. It's at the time that most of the people I knew that read comics, classmates, had stopped reading them. My parents thought they were a waste of money, but I knew right away this is what I wanted to do. The very first comic that I bought, I started copying panels and drawings out of it before I finished reading it, and declared that day that I was going to be make comics when I grew up. At the time, I still knew a lot of people would consider comics to be something of a subversive medium, including my parents, and I think that appealed to me as a teenager. They were kind of like low-grade consumer trash culture, a lot like straight-to-video genre movies, which were the other thing I was spending a lot of time on whenever I was 12, when video stores first came to my town. So, the comics allowed me to, you know, the idea was they would allow me to draw anything I could come up with. So I started making comics in 1999 while I was working as a graphic designer. My early comics were mostly mini-comics, which are similar to zines. They're typically photocopied, hand-assembled, very small editions. And then I would bring them to shows like SPX and trade with other people that were doing that. After a few years of making mini-comics, I co-created Street Angel with my writing partner, Brian Maruka. The reaction we received to that mini-comic was much more enthusiastic than anything else I had done up to that point. So we sought a publisher. We found a publisher out of California called SLG. We thought would be a good fit, sent them, followed their submission guides, and sent them a copy of the mini-comic and our plans for a series. And they agreed to it, so Street Angel became more or less my first comic with wide distribution. And it chronicles the adventures of a homeless orphan who can outfight and outskateboard anyone on Earth but struggles to feed herself and maintain her hygiene. She routinely saves the world from mad scientists, ninjas, ninja gangs, pirates, and other comic book threats while suffering insults from her classmates. On the right, she rescues this girl from the ninja gang and is insulted. She makes fun of how bad she smells on the way back from the rescue. This is a panel of her and Jesus getting into an argument after they have just defeated a bunch of demons. So she's kind of the opposite of the typical adolescent male power fantasy. All of the books have pink covers, which I used to get letters from male readers that didn't like the pink covers. Have bought the book and enjoyed it in spite of that. And she's basically a critique of the superhero genre, which is a recurring theme in a lot of my work. In the last issue of Street Angel, we introduced a character called the Aphrodisiac. He became the subject of our next graphic novel, an overview of a fake comic book superhero published in the 70s and 80s. It's sort of like a history of like a meta series. The character was inspired by blaxploitation films and superhero comics of the 70s, as well as some comics history, specifically the transition in distribution in the 70s and 80s from the newsstand distribution to what's known as the direct market. This had major ramifications throughout the comic book industry, and distribution affects content a lot more than I realized when I first started reading comics, and it's become something I'm interested in more and more as time goes on. So After DGAC kind of mirrors that particular time period of the comics market, at least the American comics market. And in a little bit, it's a response to, say, the graphic novel trend of the last 10 to 12 years in the bookstores. So, Aphrodisiac is a superhero pimp that fights monsters, Dracula, Richard Nixon, aliens, an evil supercomputer, while protecting his turf and women. It's a collection of short stories, random panels, fake comic book covers, and other art designed to suggest an entire history of this character. I followed Aphrodisiac with a mini comic called Rambo 3.5, which is a response to the media I ingested as a kid, like G.I. Joe cartoons and 80s action movies, and to the events and aftermath of 9/11. In Rambo 3, American hero John Rambo teams up with Afghan rebels to repel the Soviet army from Afghanistan. In reality, that group of freedom fighters went on to form the Taliban. So Rambo 3.5 is my attempt to process the media that informs my opinions about 9/11 and foreign policy. In this case, that means teaming up with President Bush and his dreams to save America. And Avery mentioned that one of the outstanding mini-comic award last year, SPL, so I have a few of those memories to take a closer look at. Lately, I've been making single-page comics inspired by comic book production art of the 20th century. As a self-taught cartoonist, I spent a lot of time staring at original art. For most of its history, comic book art was considered worthless. Subsequently, a lot of it was destroyed or lost. Now it exists as random pages, orphaned from its context as a longer story. I often find that to be an interesting reading experience. I've spent so much time looking at this work out of sequence and without the benefit of the rest of the stories that I've become attracted to that form of storytelling. It reminds me a lot of like film editing. I don't know if you're familiar with Walter Murch, but he's a celebrated film editor. He's written some books on film editing. And I'm paraphrasing here, but one of the things he talks about is when he's cutting a film scene together, if it's not working, if he can't get it to work, he'll cut out the main moment in the scene, and usually that solves the problem. And so what I take from that is that events have gravity, almost like throwing a rock into a lake and watching the ripples come out. And they kind of, if you were to remove those events, you still have the anticipation leading up to them, and you have reactions afterwards, and it's almost like negative space in art or something, creating the event itself even though you don't see it. So I've started doing these single pages in an effort to emulate that early interaction I had with original art. And one of the things I really like about this direction is that it resonates with my own experience in the world, where I only hear one side of a story or half of a conversation, or I have to overcome my limited point of view whenever I'm seeing a news event or something like that to try to better understand what's happening. And I feel like these pages kind of capture that feeling, that sense of incompleteness and a lot of unknown in the world. So I create these pages that are fragments of stories, character studies, dreams, and anecdotes and ideas. They're intended to be shown in galleries and in settings outside the traditional comic book market. This is I suppose, a part of that series. If you look on the left here, this is a super large comic book panel. The actual piece is 30 by 40 inches. And I did this for a show in LA. And the idea is that you can hang it on a wall and interact with it from different distances. You know, it reads one way from 20 feet away, you see a gorilla and a lizard fighting, and some chaos ensuing. But if you look on the right, that's a close-up of some of the detail on the bottom. You actually see like another level of narrative as you get closer to the piece and see people kind of scrambling through the aftermath of this typically cartoon battle. So one of the qualities I like about comics is their ability to change the meaning of the drawing based on context. And with these larger panel drawings, I'm trying to do that using scale and distance from the reader. So that's basically
Okay, well, My kind of earliest exposure to comics, the earliest things I liked were, superhero comics, like a lot of other people, like most other people. And, so all through high school, through my childhood, through high school, I always had, this idea for a big superhero epic. And, would work on it here and there. And I guess maybe in my first or second year of college, I actually met some comic pros, I guess, some actual cartoonists, people who work for Marvel, DC, publishers like that. And a lot of times they were kind of miserable and didn't really like creating, work for hire and not owning it. And so that left me a little, kind of soured on that dream and kind of looking to see what I might do next. And it was around that time that I discovered more, I guess, alternative comics. I was working in a comic shop at the time, living in Kent, Ohio, and started seeing comics like 8-Ball and Jeff Levine's work and Terry Levan's work and Peter Begg. And I just started to do some autobiographical strips, just to do something. And it kind of led me kind of down that path. Like Carolyn was saying, I did a strip for my college newspaper as well. I did it 4 days a week, which was the best trial by fire there is, because you just have to do something every day. It's a great way to really kind of just get you're motivated because you have to be. These are much later examples. I kind of continued to do this strip, over the years. I would do it in, did it for my college paper. I've done it for several weeklies. These strips ran on Richmond Magazine's, which is my home, Richmond Magazine's website. But they very much kind of get the idea across, just, slice of life, mundane, observations, that sort of thing. So that's sort of one aspect of my work. I also occasionally will kind of tackle, comics as reporting, which this is sort of an example of here. This is another piece for Richmond Magazine, but it just sort of examines. I always had a problem with the baseball stadium in our town. It's really old and just very unsatisfied with the experience, and so I decided to do a little editorial about it as comics. And it's just, I very much like using comics as a way of reporting rather than, telling a story, but just commenting on something. Don't know exactly else what else I have. Something else that I've been doing the last few years, I'm a big hockey fan, and with as many cool, interesting stories as there are in the history of hockey and the fact that it's not as well known, some of the stories, if you're Canadian, you might know all these stories, and it's, like Babe Ruth to us. But a lot of these stories are a little bit less known, and I'm fascinated by them. I'm fascinated with the time period and the way things, just the way things used to be. So I created Old Timey Hockey Tales to sort of, it's kind of a place to collect all those comics. I've never really had the attention span for a long, huge, long story. Like I said, I've tried it several times, a long, ongoing tale. So I like to work kind of in, short little spurts and that sort of thing. So that works really well for me. I'm also, honestly, my day job is I'm an illustrator, and I do a lot of freelance illustration for magazines, publications like that. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Washington City paper, but up until just a couple of years ago, I used to illustrate Savage Love every week for them, which was just a great gig, because if you're familiar with the column, it's a very frank sex advice column, and the stuff I learned about, oh man, and the challenge to try to create a, no more than about PG-13 illustration for them. It was just, again, one of those exercises that was just completely invaluable as, a professional, because you know, every week, and oh, really, it's this now. This is what they're doing. And as a result of that, I honestly don't have as much time to work. I look at the productivity of some of the other panelists. I'm blown away because it seems like I'm always struggling for time to work on comics. But it is something that I love to do, something I always will do. I think it's working on comics, at least for people like the people here, whether it's, you know, there's any money in it, you know, whether it's on a printer or screen, people are going to keep doing it because they're compelled to, no matter how, you know, how much against all common sense that goes. I know I'll keep creating. I'll probably, you know, do more Hockey Tales. The autobiographical strips I'm a little burned out on right now, but I'm sure I'll go back to that someday. I have a few other things in the hopper too. It's just a matter of finding the time to see them all through. But anyway, that's my that's me.
Now that we've heard from each of our wonderful panelists, we have about an hour.